Sick Enough, A Guide to the Medical Complications of Eating Disorders by Jennifer L. Guadiani. Part 1, Not Enough Calories. Let's start by talking about starvation. When I say starvation, I mean any situation in which not enough calories are consumed over some period of time to fulfill the body's needs. Starvation can occur in people of any body, shape, and size. It doesn't just happen in people with lower body weight, although society and the medical profession may not understand this fact. All too often, weight stigmas cause patients in larger bodies to be praised for engaging in the same eating disorder behaviors that in an underweight person would cause great alarm. Low energy intake can occur during an eating disorder or disordered eating, but it can also happen when someone goes on a diet or participates in a fast or cleanse. The Diagnostic and Statistic Manual 5, also called the DSM-5, published by the American Psychiatric Association and updated every decade or so, contains the official diagnostic criteria for mental illnesses. All eating disorders are characterized by aspects of inadequate caloric intake with attendant risks of medical complications. Practically no one with an eating disorder stopped eating and drinking altogether. That is a popular misconception. These are complicated illnesses that emerge from a combination of genetic, inherited, temperamental traits, and physiological, environmental, and sociological factors. I'll start by reviewing the definitions of the eating disorders most specially tied to an insufficient energy availability. Anorexia nervosa is diagnosed when an individual persistently restricts caloric intake, leading either to significantly low body weight, related to what is minimally expected for age, sex, and health, or to arrested growth in children or adolescents. In addition, patients experience an intense fear of gaining weight or becoming fat, develop distortions in the way they perceive their bodies, and deny the severity of their behaviors and risks of low weight. Patients' sense of self-worth becomes unduly influenced by their size and shape. Anorexia nervosa comes in two subtypes: restricting and binge eating purging. While both subtypes may manifest obsessive and compulsive overexercise, those with restricting anorexia nervosa purely limit calories. By contrast, those with purging anorexia nervosa may or may not engage in binge eating, But eating of any kind is frequently followed by compensatory behaviors such as vomiting, laxative abuse, or diuretic abuse. In both subtypes, patients, by definition, are significantly underweight. In general, anorexia nervosa has a prevalence of around 1% with a ratio of females to males of 10 to 2. In atypical anorexia nervosa, which falls under the DSM-5 heading of other specified Feeding and Eating Disorders, OSFED, patients engage in all the same behaviors and have equally severe body image distortions and fears as those with anorexia nervosa, but they are not formally underweight. Patients may lose a significant amount of weight and may be underweight relative to their typical body weight. Atypical anorexia nervosa is by far more prevalent than anorexia nervosa, occurring in up to 3% of the population in one large study. The fact that these individuals receive the designation atypical, despite representing by far the greatest number of patients with symptoms of anorexia nervosa, speaks to the ongoing problem of size stigma in the medical and mental health communities. In my clinical experience, many individuals with atypical anorexia nervosa don't believe they have an eating disorder because they aren't stereotypically emaciated. This is only reinforced by society and by medical providers who not only miss the eating disorder but praise such patients for their weight loss and presumed health when, in fact, the behaviors being used are the opposite of healthy. A recent study found that adolescents with atypical anorexia nervosa presenting to a specialized pediatric eating disorder unit were just as psychologically and medically ill as the patients with typical anorexia nervosa. In patients with atypical anorexia nervosa, if weight is checked during medical assessment, the calculation for weight suppression should be used. Weight suppression refers to the percentage of body weight loss calculated as the highest recent body weight minus the current body weight divided by the highest recent body weight. Weight suppression of even 5% in the presence of anorexia nervosa symptoms has been found to be clinically significant. Of course, given that some individuals never lose weight, the whole person and their overall medical and psychological state must also be taken into account. Individuals with atypical anorexia nervosa, regardless of body shape and size, are unquestionably sick enough to seek treatment and recovery. Patients with avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, ARFID, discussed in Chapter 14, also fail to take in enough calories, but without the focus on and distortions of body shape and size. The medical complications of starvation that will be discussed throughout Part 1 apply to them as well. In Chapter 1, I will introduce the three main medical issues that emerged from starvation: slow metabolism, organ dysfunction from insufficient energy intake, and treatment of malnutrition. These provide an organizing framework upon which we can understand most of what happens to the body when it receives inadequate calories. I will go into greater detail on each of these topics in Chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5. Chapter 1. 30,000 foot view. What happens when you starve yourself? Background. In clinical with patients and their families, when I discuss the topic of how starvation affects the body, I start by introducing the concept of the cave person brain. The cave person brain refers to the part of our brain that manages the day-to-day functions of our bodies. It takes care of us as a mammal rather than as a thinking, talking human being. It manages our temperature, digestion, heart rate, blood pressure, reproductive hormones, and to some extent our animal reactions to the world, among others. The cave person brain and metabolism. When our cave person brain senses it is not getting enough to eat, it has no insight that an eating disorder is enforcing food rules, that self-imposed or external bullying is driving a diet, or that everyone at work is doing a cleanse this week. It can only interpret, we must be in a famine, we have to protect our person. Humans have survived as a species in part due to our exquisite ability to tolerate starvation. Our ancestors frequently faced food shortages. The cave person brain evolved to be highly responsive to this stressor. When a person consumes too few calories, the cave person brain decreases their metabolic rate so that fewer calories are burned. As I will detail in Chapter 2, it does this by slowing down our heart rate, lowering our blood pressure, slowing our digestion, reducing blood flow to our hands and feet, and decreasing our feeling of energy to get things done, in order to make us hold still and conserve energy. This increases the likelihood that the person will survive until food is again available. In addition, the cave person brain fiercely strives to maintain our body weight. What is metabolism, though? It's talked about all the time, and there is a lot of pseudoscience propagated about it. While metabolism refers to all biochemical processes that sustain life, I genuinely use the term metabolism to describe what is formally called basal metabolic rate, which is the number of calories a body burns each day just by existing. Most of our daily caloric expenditure goes toward maintaining our body temperature at almost exactly 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. We also burn calories for digestion, organ function, and hormone production. We use up far more calories to maintain a consistent temperature than we do going to the gym. Exactly how the cave person brain responds to inadequate energy intake is highly variable from person to person due to genetic factors. That is, if you have four people of similar age and body size who restrict calories similarly, and move their bodies at a similar pace, they might have widely varying physiological responses. One person might develop a slow heart rate but have a normal digestion and energy. Another might have a normal heart rate but be plagued by slow digestion. Yet another might lose lots of weight, while a fourth might lose almost no weight at all. This variability poses a frustrating challenge for my patients. Many have been invalidated by medical providers and society at large. Despite severe mental illnesses that drives them to engage in serious eating disorder behaviors, they may look normal and thus don't generate appropriate concern or attention from some providers or others in their lives. Others suffer because, despite eating disorder behaviors, they have such protective genetics that they manifest almost no physical signs of malnutrition. Unfortunately, this further feeds into the eating disorder voice that tells them they must be fine since they look fine, and that they need to push harder to lose weight. Yet others can't believe how quickly they develop medical problems, even in early days of an eating disorder or at a higher weight. They see an image online or a peer who looks sicker, i.e. usually meaning thinner, while they themselves hit a medical wall at a higher weight. All of these patients suffer from not feeling sick enough. The explanation for this variability probably lies in genetic subties that we cannot yet pinpoint. Bodies clearly have different genetic susceptibilities to what I broadly call environmental exposures. When I talk with patients about this, I tend to remind them of a more familiar scenario. A 35-year-old man might die from liver failure after 10 years of heavy drinking, while a 90-year-old man on his birthday might attribute his long life to all the whiskey. What is the difference between these two heavy drinkers? All one can conclude is that they must have had different genetic sensitivities to environmental exposures. Similarly, when my patients manifest few medical issues and a stable body weight despite eating disorder behaviors, I first validate that the behaviors themselves are worthy of care and treatment. I identify they must come from survivor genetic stock. Their cave person brains are remarkably effective at defending their bodies from the effects of starvation. For others who develop medical problems early on in their eating disorder, I note they are generally genetically sensitive. It's lucky they came to the medical attention early before their eating disorder worsened. When examples of these differing clinical presentations arise, I will refer to them as genetic variability. Starvation and hormones. There is another vital way in which the cave person brain reacts to starvation besides slow metabolism. This is through radical changes in our hormones. When we starve ourselves, our brilliant cave person brain says, "Ah, I see we're in famine. This body is stressed out by too much activity and too little energy intake. Clearly, it's not safe. It's not a safe time to produce a child." Accordingly, in adolescents and adults, the part of the brain called the hypothalamus, essentially rolls hormone production back in time and produces pre-adolescent sex hormone levels, a condition called hypothalamic hypogonadism. As Chapter 3 will detail, this results in low estrogen levels and sometimes menstrual abnormalities for females and low testosterone levels for males. The complicated interplay of high stress hormones and low sex hormones in both sexes can lead to the one irreversible medical complication of prolonged malnutrition, one rarely anticipated by the patients, bone density loss. Starvation and the brain. The last major way in which the cave person brain changes in response to starvation is to become vigilant and anxious. Remember back to when your pet last experienced a big thunderstorm. For some period of time, after feeling threatened physically, your pet likely acted skittish. Maybe the cat got under the bed, eyes huge, tail puffy, claws ready. That is essentially what happens in the malnourished cave person brain too. The animal brain understands, I am at risk here, I'm vulnerable. I may not survive a dangerous encounter. So it up-radars all of its risk monitors. In a similar way, the malnourished person is constantly scanning the world for threats. That mental activity makes them much more rigid, resistant to change, and truly fearful much of the time. I have heard my patients say things like, "I'm terrified that it's almost lunchtime." I reassure them that much of this heightened animal anxiety is not fundamental to who they are and isn't even a part of their eating disorder or anxiety disorder. It's their starved brain. I encourage my patients to have faith that as they re-nourish themselves, it will improve. This same starved animal brain can make it very hard to sleep at night because, again, the brain thinks, stay a little alert in case something happens. Review the data. Are we safe? This often results in a painfully repetitive process of reviewing what was eaten that day or how much movement was performed. Ruminations not exactly conducive to sleep. I like to say that a starved person stays busy making safety plans all night long. This improves with nutritional rehabilitation. So in summary, the cave person brain is watching out for our animal body functions, the tasks we're not able to consciously alter. As people consider fad diets, like the so-called paleo diet, supposedly designed to appeal to our inner cave person, they might remember we still carry our actual cave person brain with us to this day. It's got hundreds of thousands of years of trial and error, to have figured out how best to save us from famine. Our bodies don't like to be starved. What happens when our nutritional gas tank becomes empty? Now let's turn to the broad concept of body dysfunction that occurs as a result of the nutritional gas tank being empty for too long, as I'll review further in Chapter 4. When our nutritional gas tank is empty, multiple organ systems run out of the energy they need to function normally. The most deadly example of this is hypoglycemia, meaning low blood sugar. Our bone marrow typically makes blood cells, but it stops doing so when malnourished. Our liver, which serves multiple purposes in our body, can malfunction. Our skin and hair can suffer immensely from starvation, making patients look far older than they are, with thin, brittle hair and fragile skin that easily bruises or tears and heals more slowly. Chapter 5 will cover extreme versions of body dysfunction due to malnutrition. These typically occur in patients who are profoundly underweight or who experience very rapid weight loss. The good news is that nutritional rehabilitation will resolve all of these problems. Patients, providers, and caregivers must remember that the focus of diagnosis or treatment should never be on the malfunctioning organs themselves. They are nutritional problems which require nutritional solutions. Nutritional rehabilitation. The third major mechanism of medical complications in starvation actually has to do with nutritional rehabilitation, helping starved individuals begin to nourish themselves again. Experts in the eating disorder field have moved away from the term refeeding because it sounds somewhat condescending. The term nutritional rehabilitation is both accurate and more respectful. However, the concept of refeeding syndrome is still in use, and I will use the term when necessary. Patients who need to restore the body weight can become impressively hypermetabolic. Someone who has been restricting food, causing a slowed metabolism, may need far more calories than they would imagine to restore their organ systems and body weight. Chapter 6 considers how the body responds to the reintroduction of the food. Broadly speaking, reintroducing food can be medically complicated and even a deadly process itself. There are mechanical challenges within getting enough calories into a digestive system that has slowed to a near halt in order to spare calories. Critical electrolyte and fluid shifts can, if unmonitored, lead to death by low phosphorus levels or by congestive heart failure. These critical electrolyte and fluid shifts define what is called the refeeding syndrome. Careful monitoring and medical management of these fluid and electrolyte shifts allows nutritional rehabilitation to proceed safely. The perfect child. I frequently hear the question, how does this eating disorder happen? Of course, this is a really complicated question because eating disorders are immensely complex and require a multidisciplinary team to bring clarity to any individual's illness. Ultimately, the information that is currently available to us indicates that eating disorders likely emerge from a combination of inherited, genetic, temperamental traits, and environmental and sociological factors. A diet or accidental weight loss often provides the spark in the dry grass. Everyone's story about how their disorder developed is unique. I am intensely interested in the ways the apparent medical problems actually originated from emotional distress and contributed to the development of an eating disorder. Over many years of listening to my patients' stories, through this lens, I have developed a narrative that helps describe how such situation can occur. Sometimes I use this story with my patients to validate their past experiences, especially the ways in which the medical system failed to meet their needs. I'll tell the story as if I'm reading a storybook aloud, and in this case, I will use female pronouns. There once was a little girl who, from an early age, was smart, intuitive, and sensitive. She could walk into a room and sense immediately how others were feeling. She also had a stronger than average reaction to external validation. That is, if someone praised her, she glowed. If someone criticized her, even a little bit, she closed down like a sea anemone. This little girl might have grown up in an easygoing family, or she might have had a parent with a substance use disorder, or an anger management problem, or anxiety. There might have been a sibling who was a wild child, or ill, who took up a lot of the family's attention. Sometimes, if the girl herself had a problem, like a stomach ache, a well-meaning parent might try to reassure her by saying, "You're fine." Maybe that parent looked up from their phone at that moment and those words just emerged. Maybe the parent had a hard time tolerating their child's distress and this reaction soothed the parent. Maybe the parent, a little fatigued from their super sensitive kid's reactions to the world, wanted to help her develop a tougher skin. Whether or not it was ever explicitly spoken, this little girl inferred that it was preferable for her to be fine. So she did her best. She was smart and a pleaser. She put a smile on her face and was sunny as often as possible, or at least quiet. And she was organized, driven, mature, and never a problem. Coaches, teachers, and her family called her the perfect child, words that made her glow. However, she was still super sensitive. She absorbed the world through her remarkable emotional radars, as numerous eyes of the Greek goddess Hera's multi-eyed guard Argus. And whether it was a classroom discussion about global warming, or her awareness of arguments and conflict in her family or with her friends, she was absorbing everything and feeling extra worried, anxious, and burdened. She didn't seek a way to put words to these emotions because she was supposed to be fine. But a sensitive soul can only absorb so much without any way of processing it. The little girl continued to grow, and she became more rigid in her routines, anxious around change, demanding of herself, and perfectionistic. Around middle school, hormones started to flow, her body started to change, which she didn't particularly welcome, and social dynamics became more complicated. Her sensitive self couldn't take this whirlwind of input without a way to identify, organize, and soothe her responses to it. So her stomach started to hurt. That emotional overflow appeared physically in the body, in particular during stressful times, on test days, when she would have a fight with her friend, or any time that would her worry level exceeded her ability to self-soothe. Recurrent stomach aches got attention, because the perfect child now had something medically wrong with her. Her parents took her to the pediatrician, who examined her, maybe drew some blood, even sent her to get a GI doctor. And of course, you know what they told her. You're fine. This really stung. She had a sense her whole life that maybe she wasn't actually fine emotionally, but she had managed at the best that she could. Now she had actual pain, something wrong physically, and she was once again told she's fine. So frustrating and invalidating. The parents saw this, and the symptoms persisted and maybe even escalated. They took her to a dietitian to see if the symptoms might be due to some food intolerances. The well-meaning dietitian said, "Well, let's try an elimination diet. Please avoid gluten, soy, sugar, and dairy." This would never happen with a dietitian who had expertise in eating disorders. And what did our Rue follower do? She followed that advice precisely. Because she was doing something for herself, some part of her interpreted this dietary change as self-care. For a period of time, her tummy aches went away. She thought, "Wow, I really do have some intolerances to those foods. And anyway, I want to be healthy because there are so many bad foods out there." Ultimately, this restrictive diet couldn't meet her energy needs. The girl lost some weight, and people in our weight-obsessed society said, "You look great." This positive reinforcement sealed the deal. She vowed to never go back to those old foods. The rigidity with which she adhered to her new regimen caused even more weight loss. That made her cave person brain kick in to slow her metabolism and raise her anxiety. Her belly started to hurt again and now felt terribly full just after a few bites of food. She started running as a stress relief from all the pent-up tension. Unlike her peers, she actually felt less anxious when she was underfed, and the starvation numbed her sensitivity, which was a relief. Her food rules became more demanding, and she started actively fearing weight gain and believing that her body was unacceptably large. The obsessive focus on food and body size provided a welcome distraction from the overwhelming life tasks. Her bewildered family repeatedly said, "Wait, you've lost too much weight. You have to eat, please." They watched their perfect child retreat, close off, snarl when challenged, and disconnect from the family. In a breathtakingly short time, the disorder voice had become more compelling than the voice of any loved one. This concludes chapter 1.